Welcome back to the Sentientism Podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to Yasmin Mohammed. Yasmin is an activist, charity founder, and author who advocates mainly for women living within Islamic majority countries. She founded Free Hearts, Free Minds, an organization that provides psychological and mental health support for freethinkers living within Islamic countries. Her book, Unveiled, recalls her experiences growing up in a fundamentalist household and her arranged marriage to a member of Al-Qaeda. I'd love to know what you think of the episode and the podcast as a whole, so why not write a review or give us some stars on your listening platform? Every share, review, and rating helps us nudge the world towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info or just search for sentientism on your favorite social media platform. You'll be made welcome in any of our global community groups. They're open to anyone interested in these ideas, not just sentientists. Thanks as ever for listening. Good morning, Yasmin. How are you?
Good morning. I'm really well. Thank you.
Good, good. Thank you so much for making the time to join these series of sentientist conversations. And we've talked briefly before that I'm trying to focus on what I see as the two deepest philosophical questions and the two most important philosophical questions: what's real and what matters morally, what should we care about? And I'm framing these conversations with an obvious bias that I'll be upfront about, because I'm trying to popularize and develop this really simple worldview or philosophy called sentientism that says when we're thinking about what's real, it commits to using a naturalistic approach based on evidence and reason to form probabilistic and provisional beliefs, and then to hold them lightly and with humility because there might always be more evidence. So in that sense, it has much in common with free-thinking, skeptic, atheist, humanistic ways of thinking, right? It's just a naturalistic way of thinking. And then when it comes to what matters, the clue is in the name. It suggests that we should have compassion for, we should have moral consideration for any sentient being. And in simple terms, that means any being that has the capacity to experience suffering or flourishing. And again, really, there are some wrinkles around the edges, but the shortcut summary is that's largely human and non-human animals. But having said that, I'm talking to a wide range of people who, you know, both agree with that philosophy and disagree with it. So it'll be fascinating to hear your story and see where the conversation goes. But before we get to those two central questions, for people in my audience who don't already know of you and your amazing work, how would you best introduce yourself?
So my name's Yasmin Mohammed.
That's a good place to start.
And I grew up in a fundamentalist Muslim household. I went to Islamic schools. I was put in hijab, which covers everything except for your face and hands, at the age of 9. And then at 19, I was put in niqab, which covers the face and hands, the two bits that were left over. And I was forced into a marriage with a man who my family felt was strong enough to control me. And that man was a member of Al-Qaeda. He's in prison in Egypt now. He's been there for almost 20 years. But growing up, the reason why my family felt they needed to marry me off to somebody who was strong enough to control me was because I was always questioning things. I was always pushing the boundaries. I was thinking too much. You're supposed to be a blind believer. And when you question, it's considered the devil questioning, whispering in your ear. Mm-hmm. So it's a very negative thing to be an intellectually curious person.
Yeah.
Critical thinking is incredibly discouraged, if not punished. So that was my fault. That was my crime. That was the reason why my mom called me the black sheep of the family. Yeah. Because I wouldn't just get in line like everybody else. I always had to talk about it.
And this was in Canada when you were growing up?
This is in Canada, yeah. That's a good point, because a lot of people, when they hear my story, they just assume I was like in Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia or something. They're like, nope, this was in Canada. I think people are starting to become more aware now that there are many pockets of, there are many communities like the one that I grew up in all over the Western world. Yeah. People are now starting to recognize that. In the beginning, people would be so surprised, thinking, whoa, like you were my neighbor. Like I listen to the same radio stations as you. We went to the same areas. How is this possible that you had this life and I lived such a parallel life in the same area? But I think now people are starting to see that all over the UK, all over France, all over Canada, all over America, all over these Western countries that you thought people were free to live how they wanted to live, people were safe. They're starting to recognize that no, there's a very strict community boundaries. And I think the best way in America, we have an area of Hasidic Jewish people in New York, and they're so separated from the rest of New Yorkers that English isn't even their first language. So it's such a separation living in the middle of a completely different country.
And I think
that's
something we'll come back to, because I think there is a simplistic assumption that it's really about the nation state and it's about the laws and the regulations and the culture of that nation that drives what someone's personal experience is like. And that's often not the case. As you say, there can be pockets of very distinct cultures that can have a very different feel and set of norms to them.
Yeah.
And again, we're going to revisit a lot of this stuff as we go through those two central philosophical questions. But how would you summarize your journey out of that and what your focus is now?
So I had a daughter with him, and that was really the catalyst for me feeling like I need to get out of this world, because I really did not want her to live the same life that I had lived.
It wasn't just about your oppression anymore. It was someone else at risk.
Yeah. And I was going to do anything in my power to protect her from the world that I grew up in. I didn't want that to be her life experience. And it's a very long process, Jamie, but I was able to get away from him and then to get away from my own family as well, because they were also, they're of that same belief system. So a woman on her own, living on her own, was just completely unacceptable. I was never meant to go to post-secondary. I was never meant to go to college or university. So for me to now want to do those things was frowned upon. Anyway, I was able to escape with my daughter. And the details of that are all outlined in my book.
Yeah, an amazing read.
Yeah, thank you. And then I started going to university, and two things happened when I was in university. Number one, 9/11 happened. And number two, I took a history of religions course. Now, my mom was the head of the Islamic Studies Department at the Islamic school that I attended. So she was... She's a student of Al-Azhar University, which is the most prestigious Islamic university. And as her daughter, I had to be really good in that subject because, of course, it would be a reflection on her as the head of the department. And so I took that history of religions course in university simply because I felt like, well, I know I'm going to ace a third of this course. It was about the three monotheistic religions.
Yeah, and you knew one of them already.
Exactly. I'm like, one of them, no problem. So I'm just going to take this as an easy course, basically, as an easy elective. I had no idea it was going to change my life so much. The professor of that course grew up Christian in Lebanon. And so we had that same shared Arab context.
Yeah.
And for the first time in my life, I was allowed to question. It was no longer being discouraged and I was being punished for it. In fact, I was being asked to do it, write a paper on this. I got to research things that I always wanted to. And it felt so, it was almost intoxicating. I just loved it so much. I loved being able to freely read and think and question without anybody telling me to stop. I could just keep going, keep researching, keep learning. And of course, it doesn't take long once you start learning about these religions from a critical lens. It's very quickly you realize, oh my gosh, like I've been wasting my whole life terrified of a figment of the imagination of some ancient man. Like it's just embarrassing almost that you spent so much of your life ruled by a fairy tale.
And maybe that might be a good place to actually dig into this, you know, first question that you started to talk about already about what's real. And for many of my guests, as with you, it's a story about growing up in one context, which might be religious or spiritual or naturalistic or atheistic, and then about what's real and what the fundamentals of the universe and meaning of life, those deep questions, what that means, and then how that shifted over time. But if we start with rolling the clock back to your earliest days, can you describe you can't really summarize everything, right? But can you describe the basics of what you actually believed? And did you genuinely believe those things as a child, even while you were a bit of a black sheep? What sorts of things were?
So I'm gonna tell you, and you're not gonna believe it, but genuinely it is embarrassing to admit that I did really believe these things. You're indoctrinated from birth, so that's my mea culpa.
But this is it, and I think this is a thing we'll come back to later on, right? So one of the things I try and remind myself of when I'm trying to have universal compassion is the power of those social norms, right? If everyone you care about and everyone that's around you is telling you this is the case, it's understandable this is the case, right? Yeah, sorry, carry on.
Not only telling you this is the case, but punishing you for just questioning it a little bit. That sounds suspect.
Yeah.
Let's chat about, nope, this is it. And if you think about it, then you don't have the option of not, you have to believe it. That's the only, if you believe it or you burn in hell for eternity.
Yeah.
There's no gray area. It's very black and white. You swallow this entire doctrine whole.
Yeah.
And you obey every step of the way. I'm talking about from the moment you wake up in the morning, from the moment you open your eyes in the morning, every single aspect of your life is mapped out. There's everything. You're told how to do everything. Hmm. You're told how to go to the bathroom. You're told how to eat. You're told how to cut your toenails. You're told how to everything, how to get dressed, how to put your shoes on, how to, literally every aspect of your life has rules. Hmm. So there's no opportunity for thinking. There's no opportunity for making choices and deciding things. No, you just have to do what you're told.
Yeah.
And if you've only ever lived that way, it's like the other parts of your brain almost go numb.
Yeah.
Like they just get stagnant. Yeah. And you don't use them. You just do what you're supposed to do. And then if you don't question and you don't think, you just shut down all of your feelings, shut down any anger that accepting that your husband can rape you and beat you, you're not allowed to have anger over that. Because if you have anger over that, then that means you're angry at the creator of the universe who made these laws. And who are you but peon, a little useless little human? Who are you to question the Almighty?
Yeah.
And go ahead and question the Almighty all you want. It's not going to change your life. It's not going to make any kind of difference. In fact, it's easier if you just submit, which is the definition of the word Islam. It's submission.
Yeah.
Stop fighting. Stop wiggling. Just accept it and let it happen. And then your life will flow easily.
Yeah.
But as long as you keep pushing, you're going to be unhappy.
So you would have believed in the existence of God. You would have believed in that the Quran was the incontrovertible, unchangeable word of God.
Yeah. I'll break it down for you, the story. Yeah. So this is the event. Yeah. This is how it all happened. So there's a man named Muhammad. He was an orphan and he eventually ended up getting married to a woman who was older than him. She was married. She was divorced. She had money. She was a landowner. She was a business owner. And he was this young guy that she decided to marry. So when he was married to her, he would have this habit of going to a cave and meditating there. And so he was doing that one day and he'd be fasting. Okay. So he liked solitary, sitting in a cave, not eating. One day he was doing that And he heard the voice of an angel come. It was Gabriel. And he said to him, "Read." And Muhammad said, "I can't read. I'm illiterate." And the angel said, "Read from this book. I'm now giving you the words of Allah, the words of the creator of the universe, the one God." So essentially, we're talking about an illiterate man in a cave who hasn't eaten or had anything to drink and is in solitary, and he starts hearing voices. And we're supposed to believe that those voices are the literal word of God, not metaphors like the Bible. So this is an important distinction, the literal words of Allah. So that's how this whole story starts. And then it's just throughout his life, something would happen. Let's say, for example, he wants to marry his adopted daughter. And then they'd say, "That's your daughter. You can't really marry her." "Oh, I know." So he'll go to the cave, he'll come back, and he'll be like, "Allah said, it's okay." You know what I mean? So he'll just, that kept on happening throughout his life, of course. And then when he died, that's the end of the book.
Yeah. So those were things you believed as facts. You believed the moral implications of what was laid out in the book and the rules and the hadith and the Quran. You believed in the implications for what happens after you die and potential punishments. And I guess that defined what was good and what was bad in a
it's not even good and bad. It's right and wrong. You follow Islam, you follow the Quran, you follow the hadith. You don't think about, is this a good thing to do or is this a bad thing to do? Is this the correct thing to do?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So if you think of,
it's almost
like
beyond good and bad. It's beyond.
Yeah. I'll give you a small example. When I decided to take off my hijab, I decided to stop covering my hair. My mom saw me in public without hijab on. And it was a very quick calculation that she did in her mind. And it was like almost devoid of humanity, devoid of emotion. Logically, she said to me, "If you've taken off your hijab now, then your next step is to leave Islam, because I think you're going in the wrong direction. And you need to be killed before you leave Islam. Because if you become a non-Muslim, that's on me. I will be punished for eternity for having a daughter who is an infidel because I didn't raise you properly. And I'm not going to get punished for eternity because of you." And so I'm going to make sure.
And she said this to your face?
She said this to my face.
Yeah.
And it was like, I knew she was going to say that, but you always think maybe she won't. But she did. She's a true believer.
Yeah.
And I guess it's like a mom of a Jehovah's Witness child that would decide, yes, I understand that this blood transfusion could save my child's life, but I'm not going to do it.
I had a conversation with
it. It sounds so callous and inhumane, and it is, no doubt, but it's really hard to describe that when somebody is such a believer, there is no humanity. There is no...
Yeah.
That's gone. You just follow. You don't think about what's right and wrong and good and bad. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I had a conversation with the Jehovah's Witness who came to the door a while ago. And I explicitly asked her that question. She had a son who's similar sort of age to my son. And I said, which is more important to you, your God or your son? And without hesitation, she said, God. And this woman wasn't a bad person. I think the vast majority of religious people do have what we might recognize as a morality that recognizes suffering and flourishing and so on. But this puts, when the level of belief is at that level, it puts something else above it that just is so much more important than trivial concerns of suffering and living and death. And it's almost, I like the way you put it. It's almost distinct from morality. It's almost like, okay, that's just ordinary morality. This is what really matters. This is another level.
And they hold up Abraham as such an example that he was willing to kill his son. Yeah, it is. But it's, look at his devotion. Look at his level of devotion.
Yeah.
And this is why honor killings, honor violence is so prevalent. It's so common in these communities, is because it is seen as something almost like to be admired, that you're so willing to, that you're so devoted to the religion, you're so devoted to God, you're so devoted to the right path, that you're willing to kill your own child. It's seen as a...
That's like the ultimate test,
It's the ultimate test, and you're seen as passing it because you're willing to do that. Like, you're murdering your child, but they don't think of it that way.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I left, so this is the transition that you're talking about, like what was real and, you know, what is real. It wasn't until I left Islam that I started to think about my humanity, to think about what I believe and what are these gut feelings and what is morality. These questions never came up before.
And it's been interesting in the conversations I've had so far, because most of them have had some sort of journey away from religion. Some grew up in a naturalistic context from day one. Others grew up in a religious context and then moved away. And for some, none of them were as extreme or as difficult as yours. One of my previous guests, John Adeniti, grew up in a Nigerian evangelist church and was a teacher at a Sunday school. And that was a story, again, where his family and his culture had the religion deep in its heart. So that was a difficult journey. But to be honest, all of them pale in significance to the challenges you've faced and worked through. But for most of the conversations, they have made some sort of shift from the religious to a more naturalistic worldview. And there's been a mix, because for some, it's been more a sort of technical thing about evidence and reason, and the facts just don't stack up. And I'm looking at the history of these religions, and they seem to be very human things, you know, human created things. And there are inconsistencies in the books, and hold on, look at all of these different religions. How can they all be true? So it's more of a technical evidence and reason thing. For others, it's more of an ethical thing, in that they say, okay, I'm going along with this, but those ethics just don't feel right when I see sexism or homophobia or racism or caste systems or whatever the discrimination might be, or cruel punishments or restrictions on freedom. And they'll look at those and say, okay, even if this is real, it's not something that feels like it's right for me. So I'm interested in both in your sort of early black sheep of the family phase, but also when you got to university and started studying, how much was it evidence and reason, and how much was it compassionate ethics that drew you away from it?
Because both, like I mentioned before, in my university days, I both took this history of religions course and 9/11 happened. It was a combination of both happening at the same time. Yeah. So I mentioned that my ex-husband was a member of Al-Qaeda, and there was a BBC, remember back in the day when every now and then they would go into a cave and Bin Laden had just left it, and there would be like leftover papers and computers and stuff that they would grab and try to, you know, figure out where did he go or what did he do. So there was this BBC guy dressed like all in gear. He had a helmet on and everything. And he just leans down and he picks up a random piece of paper and he says, oh, this paper says 4U Enterprises, Richmond, British Columbia, Canada. And of course, that's the company that my ex had started.
Wow.
And so I just had media just attacking my apartment building. They found out that, you know, I was his ex, and they were calling me nonstop. They were at my university trying to find me. I had one of my professors at the university saw my name on an article and he pulled me aside. And it was just like 9/11 was, I had obviously nothing to do with it. I was already divorced from this man, but because of this connection, I was horrified that I would have any connection to the people that would do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was like,
almost by association, it was just.
And you go home and you go to the mosque and people are celebrating. And I remember saying to my mom, but there is a daycare. There's little kids, because everybody is, if you're a non-Muslim, then you're not innocent. If you're a non-Muslim, then you are already the enemy, a disbeliever. So if you're killed, there's no such thing as innocent bystanders, or there's no such thing as non-military. Do you know what I mean? Mm. You know how we have these rules of like civilian, non-civil? No, that's the lines are drawn between Muslim and non-Muslim. So if you're Muslim and you're killed, then you're going to go straight to heaven because you have died for Allah. And if you are a non-Muslim and you're killed, then you deserve to die anyway. So there is no fault. There is no humanity. Again, like we were just talking, it's just like this. It was really hard for me to accept that I was part of this community, that I identified as the same people that would do this and be proud of this, and to not see the absolute evil in this.
Mm.
And so that was the emotional side of it.
Yeah.
And that's what I was petrified that my daughter would ever feel that way. Yeah. I needed to get her out of that world before she ever thought it was okay.
Yeah.
To do that to people. Yeah. So it was a combination of 9/11 and this history of religions course at the same time. And so it was just like,
yeah,
both sides.
Yeah. Pretty powerful. And where would you say that's led you to now on that side of things? Do you just have a completely naturalistic sort of science-oriented worldview? Are there still aspects of the transcendent or the spiritual or magical or the mystical that have resonance with you? Or how would you describe how you think about what's real now?
I went through a lot of different... This is a long journey. Yeah. So in the beginning, it was like, I don't believe in organized religion.
Yeah.
And then it was, maybe I'm agnostic. And then it was years later before I finally actually used the word atheist.
Yeah.
And then even atheist started to become a little bit, reminded me too much of, like, being too sure of yourself.
Yeah.
Reminded me too much of religion. I'm like, I can see a little bit of fundamentalism on this side too.
Yeah.
And so then I started to roll that back a little bit and say, okay, I'm an agnostic atheist. And it wasn't until there's a movie, a documentary called Islam and the Future of Tolerance, which is based on the book by Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz, based on their conversation. And I was supposed to go on a movie tour around Australia to promote that movie because I'm in it for 30 seconds, but I was supposed to go with Majid Nawaz and we were supposed to promote the movie. And
directed by Jay Shapiro, wasn't it? So I had some great conversations with him. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, he's a wonderful human being. And I was going through a really rough time. I was agoraphobic. I was suicidal. I was having panic attacks. I couldn't even work and I was going to force myself. And then I just was I just came to the point, this realization, like I can't even, it was basically my husband saying, look, I can't even get you to walk down to the beach. How do you think you're going to go to Australia and do this movie tour? Like you have to write to Sam and say, you can't do this. So I wrote to Sam and I said, this is my situation and I don't think I'm going to be able to do the movie tour. He didn't even care. He was just like, how are you doing? You know, what, tell me about your symptoms. And he, of course, got me into meditation. And that was the first time in my life. And if it wasn't for my absolute trust in Sam, I just thought it was a bunch of woo-woo. I'm like, meditation. I love the Sam Harris guy, but honestly, his meditation stuff, like, but I did get into it and it literally saved my life. I'm not even, it's no exaggeration.
Wow.
It saved my, I don't know. I was doing everything after that. I was like doing acupunctures, I was trying everything. I had obviously tried the route of antidepressants and everything else. And so I was trying to find a way to live without being in this constant state of panic.
Mm.
And the meditation really helped me. And so that changed me from being a full-on rational, logical, if it's not real, then it doesn't exist. You know what I mean? Like I was very much in that space. But because of my personal experience with meditation, I realized, okay, there's a lot that I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot that we don't know. And even just because science can't explain it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that science hasn't explained it yet.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
And it just opened my...
I think I've followed a similar path, and quite a few of my guests have as well. Some have come out of a religious context, gone through an angry atheist phase, and then drifted back to something that's still somewhat transcendental, or the universe is God, yeah, or some sort of Spinozan view. Others, and I think you and I probably share this, have gone through, yeah, a bit of an angry atheist phase, but then a sense that, hold on, although atheism just means the lack of belief in God, which is actually quite, on that basis, all agnostics are atheists as well, right? It's not a contentious thing. There's a tone sometimes in the movement or the way the messages are pronounced that sound like I am 100% totally confident that this is crazy and impossible. And I'm quite close to that, but I still, you know, don't like to get to 100%. Well, and there's also a theme in, even in a naturalistic and maybe in a scientific worldview, that can sometimes come across as overconfident, dogmatic, insistent. And I have to keep reminding myself that the real core of a naturalistic way of thinking is radical open-mindedness, deep uncertainty, humility, skepticism, even of our own perception. So that still means you don't believe in things when there's no evidence, but you also remain open-minded because all sorts of crazy things have already been demonstrated to likely be true. So that's why I come back to this idea of having provisional and probabilistic beliefs. The only things we should be 100% sure of are formal systems like maths. Everything else, keep an open mind. So,
I would say that I agree with the 100% in that I know for sure this being, if there is a being or whatever, this energy or this whatever, did not write that book, did not send.
How close I can get to 99.9999% confident.
I'm 100% sure he didn't write this book.
All right,
there's absolutely no doubt in my mind. So that I can be sure of. But that doesn't mean that there isn't something out there that I don't know of that could be true.
Yeah,
I just know what isn't true for sure.
That's fair enough. And I think that's, to be clear, right, there are certain things that I'm so highly confident of. I'd still technically say it's not 100% because if it's 100%, then you stop thinking. But it's so close to being 100% that, in normal language, I will say I'm sure of it. It's been proven. It's definite, right? It's as near as damn it. But at the same time, you don't need to have 100% knowledge or to have something proven for it to be probabilistically confident enough that you can use it in daily life and make sensible decisions, right? Just because something's probabilistic doesn't mean it's not useful. And on the flip side, there are an infinite number of things for which there's no evidence that you could choose to believe. Yeah. So I don't even know how you'd start. So if there's evidence for something, then believe based on how strong that evidence is. If there's no evidence for it, it's a completely arbitrary choice to believe it, right? You could believe literally anything, and lots of people do. But at the same time, I still come back to that needing to have humility and open-mindedness in the naturalistic way of thinking. And that's just a mind-blowing story. And we've touched on this already because I think it's hard to separate the two questions, but the second question is what matters morally. And in a way, you've laid out already from your early life what you believed mattered, and this sense of there being a sort of superordinate thing that was almost even more important than morality. But one of the reasons that some people are hesitant about moving away from a religious or a supernatural worldview is because they're worried it'll shake their moral foundations. So however flawed a religion or a supernatural way of thinking might be, at least it's reasonably clear, right, that there's a deity that instantiates right and wrong. There's a list of rules that you can follow. And of course, they're open to interpretation, but at least there's something you can look at. Mm-hmm. And if you put that to one side, some people are nervous that you have no morality at all. So you go into some sort of nihilistic, nothing matters, let's just run around and kill each other for fun mindset, which I don't think is a philosophy you or I adopt. From what I know of you. But some they'll put that supernatural thing to one side and they'll go down the sort of nihilistic, nothing matters route, which normally is quite a temporary teenage thing, and then they mature out of it. Some will do something that I think is very similar, which is a relativistic approach, they'll say, look, there's no externally defined morality. There is no God. But then morality is something that we as groups of humans just negotiate amongst ourselves. There's no objective right or wrong. If a group agrees with a certain set of norms, then they are by definition within that group correct. And I see that way of thinking is deeply insidious, because those groups and the negotiations of morals within them are normally driven by the powerful people within those groups. And again, they can be largely arbitrary in terms of the moral rules they come up with. And if from the outside you stand back and say, who are we to judge? They've agreed that it's fine to throw gay people off roofs, or to discriminate against Dalit caste members, or to not let women into being in the senior levels of the Catholic Church, or to deny contraception, or to threaten children with eternal torture. Who am I to judge? That's absolutely fine. They've negotiated that culture. Off you go. So I think that relativistic approach is deeply dangerous as well. And I don't think you obviously haven't followed that path either. So where have you gone? What would you say your morality is now grounded in? What matters morally to you?
So I think just the one thing to add to what you were saying is that there is this fallacy when people say that religion is an objective morality. Mm. No, it's not. We still created that. So what you just described about those small groups of people creating these arbitrary rules and laws, that's all religion is. So that's what we did. We did that. We decided, a group of humans decided that it was okay to do this or that. So there, none of that is objective. All of these, let's say, so these three monotheistic religions, do they believe in the same one God? I don't know, but whatever. He tends to give different rules to different groups of people, which seems confusing. Like, why would he do that? We know that there is no such thing. We know, obviously some people don't agree with us, but there is no one God that is giving one set of rules. Every single group of religion or cult or whatever are coming up with their own random rules. Mm. When you realize that, because it is scary, it is so scary. I talked about everything being laid out from the moment I open my eyes in the morning till the moment I go to bed at night. Every single step of the way is laid out. It's called a sirat al-mustaqim. That means the long, straight path. Mm. And when it is put up as a visual, it's like a tightrope.
Yeah.
And the tightrope, underneath the tightrope are the burning fires of hell. And as a Muslim, you have to walk on this tightrope so carefully. And if you misstep, boom, down you go. So it's such pressure, such anxiety, such fear, that you just always have to be one step ahead, following every single rule. Mm. And it can turn you, like, it really messes with your head. And everything's in threes too. Like, I'm sure Muhammad had some OCD in there. Everything is these repetitious things. It's just, it messes you up, right? It messes you up if you were normal to begin with, because most of the time we're born into it. But you don't realize how messed up you are until you walk out of it. And that's why in my book, I said I was a fish that didn't realize it was wet.
Yeah.
Until I got out on dry land. And then I was like, holy shit. I cannot believe I believed those things and I lived in that world.
So it must have felt like you were jumping off the tightrope and hoping that the hell wasn't real. And then
it was believing that I wasn't on a tightrope anymore.
Yeah. Okay.
And believing that hell was not below me anymore.
Yeah.
And
that's the freeing thing.
More difficult than I can possibly describe to you, because it's in your psyche.
Yeah.
It's in your mind. So even if you logically, even if you can see, I don't know how to explain this properly here, you understand this is reality, but still your body carries that fear.
Yeah.
It's in you physically. It's in your mind. Whether it takes a long time to clean all that brainwashing out, all that indoctrination takes a long time to get it to leave your body. Sometimes you don't even realize it's there. One of my friends I was speaking to, her and I both left Islam around the same time. This is almost 20 years ago. And she said that sometimes she'll find herself looking at something and making a judgment. And then she'll be like, oh gosh, I didn't realize that was still in there. So you're like judging somebody for being gay or judging a woman for her wearing shorts or something. And you're like disgusted at yourself. Like, oh, I didn't know that sort of those remnants of judgment for these things are still in there. But yeah, it takes a long time to cleanse all that out. But to go from such order where everything is clean, clear, black and white. My mom used to say, look at these silly non-Muslims with their libraries full of books. All we need is one book.
Yeah.
And it was something to be proud of, like something that just
clarity
gave her life such simplicity. Yes.
Yeah.
She thought it was so easy. Why would you choose to live such a confusing life where there are so many different answers when you can just follow this one straight path with all of the clear answers?
You're tempting me.
Oh, man. It just was, even as a kid,
Yeah, it sounds
like,
quite compelling, doesn't it?
It didn't to me, but I understand that it does to some people.
Yeah.
Like, I understand there are some people that really like that.
Sort of reassuring and...
It is, yeah, I guess.
Given the uncertainty of the world and the confusing complexity of everything that's going on, this is the answer.
Yeah. But for somebody who was born into and raised into nothing but this order, there's such a... Just this, that natural human curiosity.
Yeah.
It was so hard to stifle that. And so when my mom would say, oh, there's just this one book, I'd be like, oh, I want more books though.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to read more. I want to learn more. I hated that I was being squished into this is your answer right here. No, I want to think about it. I want to question it. I want to look at the different answers out there, and I want to, what are the options? But that's,
this is the only answer.
And then
so
you,
maybe,
sorry, go
other
on.
Way, like maybe your perspective of being in chaos and there is no straight answer, then I can understand that it can be enticing for you to say, okay, these are the answers. So going from this way to that, I can see it. And then sometimes I did feel that way. Sometimes I did feel like it would be a lot easier if there was just somewhere to go. Someone to ask, something to refer to get the right answer for this.
And now you've freed yourself. You've read all the books. What is the answer?
Am
I being a bit silly? But right, how would you define your morality now? What matters to you morally? What? And I've got a strong sense of that already from the way you describe things. But how would you know? Can you summarize?
Yeah, it was really a matter of not even rebuilding myself, but building myself. So I like to use the analogy that Majid Nawaz talks about in his book, Radical, because when he described it, I was like, oh my gosh, that was exactly my experience. He said, you were building yourself. So what you did was you pick up every brick and you turn it every which way. And you really think about, is this a brick that I want to put in my foundation? So for every single issue, I had to do that. And I had to really look at things, question it to death, research it, understand it, see how I felt about it. And sometimes those bricks would change over time.
Yeah.
But it was like a very fluid building.
Yeah. But it was a construction process. Yeah.
It's a construction process that's very slow and very, what's the word I'm looking for? Just very focused, very careful. That's exactly the word I was looking for. Yes. Yeah. It's a very deliberate process. And I had to do that with everything. I remember at one point somebody saying something about male circumcision. Female circumcision, fine. We already obviously established, accepted. I had no problem understanding that was a vicious and horrible thing to do.
Mm.
And then it came to male circumcision, because it's so normalized, I remember sitting there and having to think about it and having to research it. And then understanding finally, okay, so why is it different? This is a healthy female baby. This is a healthy male baby. Why am I horrified at a healthy female genitals getting cut with a razor, but not horrified at healthy male genital? Of course, it's the same thing. You have to come to that. And capital punishment, same thing. I had to come to that because I grew up in a very eye for an eye of worldview that it was weird for me. Why would we keep this person alive and feed them and house them and clothe them when they're somebody who's killed children? Do you know what I mean? No, they deserve to die. And so it took me a long time to come to the point where I'm at right now, whereas no, I completely don't believe in capital punishment at all. I don't think that there's any reason for anyone to execute another human being. So yeah, that's basically what it is, one by one.
And let me have a go at guessing what you're, or suggesting a way of framing what that morality is. And it's super common sense, right? It's almost seems silly to say it, but needlessly causing suffering and death is a bad thing. And the weird thing, I think, is that many people, most people around the world would agree with that statement. But when you follow it through, it bumps up against a lot of social norms that we've come to accept are normal or acceptable. And that's where the challenge starts. But I think it's still a useful place to start, because that's personally, that's in a way, that's where I've come to this idea of sentientism. I've rejected the supernatural ethics. I've rejected the relativistic thing that says anything goes. I also don't really believe in a sort of moral realism that says there are perfect moral truths floating out there in the universe that were around even before sentient beings existed, right? Before sentient beings started maybe in the Cambrian, I don't think there was any morality at all, right? I think there was proto-morality with pre-humans that evolved because of kin and reciprocity, and that collaboration can be useful in an evolutionary context. I think we've evolved with the ability to do super advanced modeling of ourselves and others and the environment, and develop the cognitive capacity to pick up what we were given, the morality we were given by evolution, and to enhance it and formalize it and mess it up in awful ways, but also refine it in positive ways. So in a way, while I'm not a moral realist in that sort of perfect sense, I am a moral realist in the sense that my morality is grounded in an understanding of what sentient beings, including humans, are. That's an imperfect understanding as science develops and our own experience develops. But it's also an understanding of what our experiences moment to moment are as well. And in simple terms, I don't like suffering. I'm pretty sure you don't either. And morality, in a way, it's just the choice to care about others. Once you put a supernatural ethics to the side, it almost seems tautological. That's what morality is. So it feels to me from what you said that you probably share something along those lines, that you see needlessly causing suffering and death as a bad thing. But as I said, many people would agree with that statement, but then disagree with the way you or I get to on our specific decisions about what's good or bad. And that includes many religious people, because one of the things that's common in lots of religions is there is a really deep, rich vein of compassion that runs through most religions. And I'd argue that most religious people are more compassionate than their religion and more compassionate than their religious leaders. The religious people as a whole are generally much more compassionate, because I think at least intuitively they share this sort of ethic that suffering is a bad thing, right? Regardless of what someone tells you. But in a supernatural or religious context, that compassion is restricted often to an end group, or it's conditional on you following the tightrope, or it's conditional on you, you know, following the commandments or all the social norms. So there is compassion there. And I think that gives me hope that there's still a common ground. Most people don't like needlessly causing suffering. There's common ground. But the compassion is conditional and constrained. And that's what I'm trying to get to with, I think both universal humanism tries to break that and say, look, no, all humans matter. All humans matter morally. And it breaks out of that. And in a way, sentientism is trying to do the same thing, but go to the next level and say all sentient beings matter. Because I think in a way, compassion isn't enough. The most important thing is, okay, that's great, you're a compassionate person. But if you're only compassionate for this tiny set of people, or a subgroup, or your in-group, that's not good enough. You need some universality. So one of the interesting things would be to go, you've already talked about part of your journey, because in a sense, would you say you probably were compassionate for the Ummah and for all Muslims, and then you broadened that out to have a compassion for all humanity?
Yes, that was very weird to do that.
Was that part of the journey, recognizing that apostates like me do actually have some moral salience, which to be honest, I think many millions of Muslims would agree with. So again, the story you've described is a particular subset of Islam that is much more prevalent than people would like to admit. But at the same time, Islam is also
us and them that you described is that's very pervasive.
I mean, and when you read the Quran, that's one of the themes that comes through so strongly, is that us and them. It's quite hard to avoid that. And I respect a lot of most of the Muslims I know have gone through a journey that's similar to those in many other religions of saying, we're going to cherry pick and put that to one side and live in a much more universal humanistic way, which is appreciated, and more power to them as they do that. But one of the other interesting things about your journey, and this is the distinction, if you like, between a sort of humanism and sentientism, is at what point you started to think about non-human animal ethics as well. And one, I guess, I'd be interested to know whether your Islamic structure had much to say about non-human animals and whether that played into your thoughts then, and then how that shifted since as well, because it sounds like you and your family have been on a bit of a journey about, you know, veganism and non-human animals and how that's played into the story. Because for me, that's another really important step beyond humanism, is to recognize that other beings can suffer too, and that matters.
For sure. Yeah. So Islam teaches that their animals are made for humans. I think it's maybe similar to the Christian view. I'm not sure, but that kind of thing of like
there's a sort of dominion theme that comes through some schools of Christianity, which is very similar, or that we're in stewardship of the animals, but they're there for our purposes. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So there isn't this idea of humans simply being animals. That's something that is not accepted. Like there's a clear distinction between humans and animals.
Yeah.
And accepting, understanding, learning that humans were just animals was a journey for me.
Yeah. Another
mind-blowing shift. And when you go through that, what you talked about, having compassion for the ummah and then expanding that. And I remember how I said that was really weird. It was, because it was, you thought of them as the other, the enemy, the ones that want you dead or the ones that want to hurt you. So to start to think of yourself as not just part of this ummah, but connected with other humans, it expanded your heart and your mind in a way that was really beautiful. Like, it just felt so, it's almost like when you realize that we're all stardust. Yeah, it was just that feeling of it's just so transcendent.
A sense of connectedness.
Like, gosh, yes.
Yeah.
I'm connected with all these people and we all share humanity. Like, it was just this really beautiful sense to get that understanding. Same thing when I started to realize that humans are just animals. I went through the same thing, but it felt like on a much grander scale, because it's not just humans, but animals too. You'd see the little baby whale and the mama whale, and you'd be like, oh my gosh, that's like me with my daughter. And you just start to not look at them as just an other, but they are us and we are them. And so it was, again, it was that same feeling of just interconnected beauty, wonderful, transcendent, miraculous, mysterious wonder. Like, it was just really, it just felt really good to recognize that. And then, of course, yes. So I'll tell you, to be perfectly honest, what got us into becoming vegetarians was my daughter. She was about 4 or 5 years old. We were having a barbecue.
Yeah.
And so we had the kids' table, and my husband had barbecued a big plate of drumsticks for them. So telling this story always horrifies me. So he brought the big plate of drumsticks and he put it on the kids' table. And my little daughter said, whoa, how many chickens did you kill to get all of those legs?
Yeah.
And I was just like, we are horrible parents. Yeah, because I'd never thought of it that way. Like, even growing up, I know I realized this sounds weird, but I didn't connect in my head, this is beef. And this is a cow. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is a drumstick.
Yeah.
And this is a chicken. Chickens are on the farm and cows are on the farm. Drumsticks and beef are on our plate. I didn't make the connection that she made.
And even the words used are deliberately distinct, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And when she made that connection, it was like she was making it for me. Like I, as an adult, had never even made that connection, yeah. really. I grew up with this understanding of it as a separate thing. And I never really, I knew cognitively I understood, but I hadn't really, yeah. it never hit me like that.
And
so when she said that,
sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so that was the day my husband and I sat down and we're like, what are we doing? This is horrific. Like this was like a murder scene that we put out. Oh, and then we decided to be vegetarian at that point.
Yeah.
And now it's really good that things are becoming a lot more accessible, because at the time it was really the meat alternatives were really just punishing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's getting so much easier now.
It's getting so much easier.
I think veganism now, it depends where you live, there's a massive variety, but certainly in many places, veganism now is where vegetarianism was 15 years ago now. The availability yeah. and the alternatives and so on, it's so much easier. And I've interviewed some people who have deep respect for them, because I went vegetarian maybe 24, 25 years ago. That was pretty easy. And I've only been vegan for 3 or 4 years now. I've spoken to some of the people I've interviewed who went vegan in like the 1960s and 70s. And oh. it was a whole different level of challenge.
Yeah, they were just eating a lot of lentils.
Yeah, exactly. but it's interesting. And I'm sometimes guilty of drawing maybe too strong a parallel between these two things. But I do think there's something in this journey from religion to naturalism and from a related journey around animal ethics. Because in a sense, the end point of both to me seems, and I think to you, seems pretty obvious, right? You take a naturalistic worldview based on evidence and reason, because engaging with reality is surely the best way of understanding reality. And you recognize that suffering matters regardless of whether it's a human or an animal. You don't have to say they matter in the same way or to the same degree, but they matter at least. You wouldn't want to necessarily cause them. But in both cases, the societal norms are so powerful and strong. And in a way, it is almost another form of indoctrination, the same way as you can be indoctrinated into believing a certain religious or a supernatural set of beliefs and morals and ethics. We're also indoctrinated, nearly everyone around the world is indoctrinated into thinking it's, you know, normal, necessary, natural to, you know, pay other people to harm and kill sentient beings, basically for our pleasure. There are some people that, for whom it's a survival thing, and absolutely fine. Let's have a conversation about the trade-off. But for the vast majority of people, it is just a transient pleasure preference. So it's that there does seem to be a parallel there, where the logic seems pretty easy and straightforward. If humans were completely rational, they just watch this podcast and everyone would agree with this instantaneously. But actually, the biggest problem is those sets of really rigid, strong, powerful, emotionally resonant social norms that both blind people to, you know, for example, the reality of animal agriculture, but blind people to the challenges of religion as well. But they're two of my pet topics. So maybe I draw a stronger parallel around the journey away from both.
I definitely see that parallel. I agree with you. And that mirrors my experience as well.
Yeah, it's a fascinating journey. And it's interesting that it was your 4 or 5 year old daughter that sort of had the clarity of childish thinking to cut through it. Often that's needed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again,
she was brought up with no religion, right? So yeah. And she's such a curious mind. Honestly, at 3 years old, she was asking me questions that like Google can't answer. So it's weird because she reminds me so much of myself when I was her age, like physically and her personality too. And quite often I would look at her and I think that's who, if my brain wasn't stifled, this is the potential that was stifled in me, because she's so curious and she's asking so many questions all the time. And that's who I was. Yeah. Except that, of course, when she asks them, we try to find the answers together and we talk about it. Yeah. She
sounds awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah. And so one of the things I want to touch on, which is a personal bugbear of me, because we're going to go on next to talk about the future and, you know, how we can try and make the world a more compassionate, hopefully naturalistic place as well. But one bugbear of mine on the animal ethics front is that I try and have compassion. It's a difficult journey because once you've seen the reality of animal agriculture and fishing, it's such a visceral, obvious ethical horror that the natural next step, as with many social human social justice causes, is to get preachy and righteous and some somewhat aggressive and to be pushy because you can't understand why other people can't see it. And I'm guilty of that sometimes when the snark escapes on Twitter sometimes. But I try and rein that in because partly because this idea of sentientism, like humanism, is supposed to have a universal compassion. So that involves being compassionate for the people you disagree with as well. And that's super hard. But one thing that helps me is that I remind myself that I was one of those people not very long ago. I consumed meat and dairy for a long while and just deliberately didn't think about the topic because I knew it would lead me to a place that would be seen as socially weird and I'd have to make changes I didn't want to make. I was vegetarian for a long while and then went vegan. So that's one source of compassion, is just to remind myself that, one, I'm not perfect now. There is no such thing as a perfect suffering free life, right? Even the purest vegan still causes harm, whether they like it or not, and death. So one, there's no perfection, but two, we are all going on a journey. And very recently, I wasn't a bad person before I went vegetarian or vegan. These social norms are so strong and powerful that helps me have compassion for other people. And I particularly have that feeling for the average person, right? People are busy. They have challenging lives. They have, in some cases, survival concerns. They've got their families to focus on. I can't expect them to do the hard moral work of thinking about fish and eggs and dairy and meat products and supply chains and ethical consumption. It's hard to have that expectation of everybody. I'd love it, but for the average person on the street, it's understandable why they don't. They've had these social norms pushed onto them. They live as part of them and they have other pressures. But I do have a pet peeve about atheists, humanists, careful skeptic thinkers, people who put themselves forward as moral or intellectual leaders who are very proud of the fact that they've dropped one set of strong social norms around a religious way of thinking and they've followed the path of evidence and reason and compassion to a more ethical worldview, yet remain completely blind to the challenges of non-human animals. So I have a sort of special pet peeve for people who intellectually and morally I deeply admire, and we've talked about some of them today on your journey, but who still have this mental block around non-human animal ethics that to me just feels like the religious people they criticize. There's another block. It's like the topic is like kryptonite. I don't know if you have so that's just my rant over, but I don't know if you have a thought about why, you know, veganism, animal advocacy, and non-human animal ethics are seen in such a sort of challenging light by so many in the atheist and humanistic and free-thinking rationalistic worlds.
I don't know if it's necessarily challenging. I think they just haven't challenged it yet. I think it's when I was describing myself as a fish who didn't realize I was wet. I think that it's just they didn't have that moment, like when my daughter said, "How many chickens did you kill?" Yeah. Like you need to have that moment. And that can come in many different ways. It can come from watching a documentary. It can come from whatever, different life experience. It's going to make you start to question it. Maybe listening to your podcast could do it. Who knows? But it has to be something that will pierce through and then cause them to go, hang on a minute, what is this? And then just start to think about it. But they've just never, it's never crossed their mind to start that challenging thought process to begin with. That's what I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's also it comes back to the theme we touched on earlier about this need for humility. And there's a danger, I think, in the atheist community that because, you know, we're so confident we're right about atheism that we forget that we might have dogmas in other areas of our thinking. And the same is true in the vegan movement as well. We're so confident we're right about animal ethics and animal agriculture that we forget we have dogmas and problems in other areas as well and restricted compassion in our own. Yeah,
I'll get the human condition.
I think it is. Just because you're right in one area doesn't mean you're right in all others. The final section that I wanted to come onto with you in these conversations is thinking about the future. So we've framed this sort of odd situation where I think you and I share a naturalistic way of thinking about the world. We share a, you know, roughly sentiocentric view of the world, which says all types of suffering matter, whether it's human or not, and let's try not to cause it if we can avoid it. But most of the planet disagree with us. Because of these sets of social norms, either people have supernatural ways of thinking, religious ways of thinking, or they have restricted scopes of compassion that exclude most non-human animals and often exclude many humans as well, as we know from the ongoing problems we have about in-groups and out-groups and various forms of discrimination as well. So in that context, where we think the answer is obvious, but nearly everyone disagrees, there's two questions. One is, if we took a more utopian cast and imagined a future world that was more where 7.8 billion people were more broadly compassionate and had a more naturalistic worldview, what might that future look like? But then to drag us back to reality, pragmatically, how do you think we can best get there? And it'd be interesting to, in that context, hear about some of your projects and campaigns, of course, because they feed into trying to make the world a better place.
I've had to accept the fact that humans are just not rational beings. It's
not completely.
No, we are very emotion driven. I've had people say to me, I know that this religion is very toxic. I know that it hurts people. I know that it's misogynist. I know that it's homophobic. I know all of these things, but I want to maintain my friendships and my job or my family connections or whatever it is. So I'm just going to continue to identify with this religion, even though I cognitively understand that it's not the truth or whatever.
So it's do you think the prevalence of that within religious communities is underestimated? Do you think there are lots of people out there?
Especially with Muslims, because the punishment for leaving Islam is execution. And that punishment isn't only carried out by the state, like in 15 different countries, it's actually in the law. But it can be carried out by any believing Muslim. So there's in Islam, any person is responsible for keeping the ummah on track.
Yeah.
So this is why I'll take the very famous case of Salman Rushdie, when there was a fatwa for him to be killed because of the satanic verses.
Yeah.
It was like anybody can do that. It's not like it has to be done by a state or be executed, and he's not going to get tried and have his day in court or whatever. So it's terrifying to admit that you don't believe in this religion anymore and that you don't want to be a part of it anymore, because it's not only societal consequences, but there's actual like mortal consequences real risks. And that's why I started the organization Free Hearts, Free Minds. So it's Free Hearts, Free Minds. Free Hearts is because anybody part of the LGBT community can be executed for the crime of not being in a opposite sex relationship. And anybody who denounces Islam can be executed. So that's the Free Hearts and the Free Minds. And so in my organization, I provide what was most helpful to me, and that's mental health support. So through generous donations of wonderful human beings around the world that support the organization, and then I use those funds to pay for therapists. Some of my therapists grew up Muslim and some of them did not, but have worked in the Middle East or have worked with refugees, worked in this context for a long time. And so have a real understanding. And basically via Zoom or Skype, they offer mental health support, offer therapy, offer tools for the person to get to a point where they can feel strong enough at that point to make a decision of what's the best way for me to find my happiness. Is it escaping from this country? Is it getting financially stable? Is it getting out of this abusive relationship? It's individualized for every person. And
that's super powerful, because you're reaching directly into these communities and groups and actually helping the oppressed people suffering and at risk.
One by one.
Yeah.
And so we only support people that are in Muslim majority countries, because if you're in a Western country, you probably have social supports that will be able to support you in whatever country you're in. But if you're in Somalia, Egypt, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, Mauritania, Morocco, I'm thinking of all the countries that are on my waiting list right now, Nigeria, you don't have those social supports. You cannot go see a therapist and admit that you're gay or admit that you're an atheist. These are things that could get you killed.
And you've got nowhere to turn.
Exactly. So that's why I would say 100% of the people that contact us are in a state where they're feeling suicidal, because mm-hmm. they feel like there's nowhere else, there's nothing that I can do. And what we hear more than anything is, I'd rather be dead than continue living this life. Because you're living a lie, which is a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
That's why my mom saw me without hijab that day, was because I was so sick and tired of living a lie. I was living a double life. Everybody in my life knew that I wasn't wearing hijab, except I would still put it on for my mom, for her to see me.
It's hard to imagine the psychological pressure that must put on you.
It's like, I guess, what it would be like, and this is why I have Free Hearts as part of my organization, because even though I'm straight, I can understand that feeling of maybe 30 years ago having to deny who you are because society won't accept it.
Yeah, living
a lie. So you are living a lie. We call it in the closet and getting out of the closet. As ex-Muslims, we say, are you still in the closet? Essentially, do your friends and family know?
There's a parallel.
Like, oh, I'm partially in the closet. Yeah, so we have those. Dave Rubin and I have had these conversations where he talks about when he was in the closet, he was doing stand-up comedy where he was being straight up homophobic. And then after the set was over, he'd go hook up with a guy. Like, it was just, you're in such a
dissonance.
Very damaging to your psyche to live like that. And so that's what a lot of these people were in the Muslim majority world. This is how they have to live. They have to live in that horrible toxic space of just lying all the time. And it's gross. You feel like it rots your soul. I don't know how to describe it, but it's a very horrible place to be.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And it's powerful because you're reaching in, as I said, to help support the individuals who are oppressed in a way that's powerful to them and is deeply needed. But there's some, and I know you've written and talked a lot about your frustration with the degree to which other people around the world recognize that as an issue and are willing to engage with it. And I think, from my amateurish perspective, there's a couple of things that hold people back or put them on the wrong path. One is this relativistic approach we talked about before, where you say, who am I to judge? It's their culture. Any culture is as equivalent as any other, regardless of the suffering and pain being caused. Fine, they've agreed that's it. Ignoring the fact that the people who agreed the rules for that were a very small group of very powerful, normally men, and there are many oppressed people within those communities. So that relativistic approach almost provides a force field and a shield for either traditions or religions.
Like, it's you happen to be born into that group, so
unlucky.
That's just your luck. You're just going to have to put up with it.
And there's
I don't care about you.
It feels that way. And I think there's another angle which relates to it, links to it, which I think comes from a more compassionate place and a better motivation, but it still ends up taking a wrong path, which is
the road to hell, as they say.
Yeah. And here's how I think that the narrative often works. It's, for example, we're part of a privileged Western rich culture. That group is often marginalized and challenged and oppressed. I want to have an open-minded respect for alternative points of view and different cultures and different ways of life. And so all of that sounds quite positive, right? And at the same time, I'm also very aware that while this Western, which is a term I don't really like very much, but while this Western culture that I am privileged to be part of, might have some good things to contribute to the world, also has some very challenging history around colonialism and oppression of other marginalized groups and so on. So that sets up this actually quite a positive motivation where people are saying, look, I want to be humble. I want to respect others and different viewpoints. But where that then leads is that respecting other viewpoints turns into a deference for other viewpoints and a sort of erasure or ignoring of the real experiences of individual oppressed people within those groups. So it feels deeply frustrating to me because you can see why they're coming from a good place with people trying to be humble and trying to be open-minded and trying to be respectful of others. But in so doing, they're just not facing up to some really visceral, obvious, direct, needless harms.
Yes, I hear what you're saying. and I reject it.
Okay.
So
well, yeah, and I do too.
Yeah.
Because for me, what matters is the experiences of the individual people and whether they're suffering. That's the problem that we need to be able to engage with, regardless of the context.
And for a person to have the mindset where they think, I'm a privileged Westerner, and these are my ideals or these are my values, but not everybody has them, is making this assumption that you are somehow superior to all other people.
Yeah, it's actually arrogant.
Please give me a fucking break. Do you think that you invented feminism? Do you think that you invented liberalism? Do you think that you invented humanism? The West are the ones who were able to codify these things and to live by these things in a true way that is remarkable and impressive. And I'm appreciative to have that as a guiding light. But these are human ideas.
Yes.
People were being killed for having these ideas hundreds of years before the West existed.
Yeah, thousands
so
even.
Yes, exactly. Thousands, you're absolutely correct. So let's just stop with the whole, I don't want to judge the little brown savages because they don't know any better. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's patronizing. It's arrogant.
It's so patronizing. It's so condescending. It's so infuriating. And you are automatically creating that group.
Yeah.
Separation,
us
and them. You are buying into that and you are perpetuating that. There is no us and them. Like when they talk about, so in 2010, Sam Harris has this TED talk where he brings up a picture of these women in burqas in Afghanistan. So it's like this sea of women. You wouldn't know they're women because they're all covered head to toe in these, where they're looking outside of like a mesh. And he says to the audience, who are we to pretend that this is not horrifying? And I cried like I had pent up 20 years of tears when I watched that TED talk, because it was the first time that I had ever heard anybody on a mainstream stage talk about us as if we were human fucking beings. It was the first time that we were regarded as just human beings like everybody else. Yeah. Yes, for so many years, I would have to endure people saying things like, but they want to wear that, but they like wearing that, but it's empowering for them. Mm. Are we a subspecies? Why would women from a different geographical location enjoy covering themselves up head to toe when you wouldn't? Do you not recognize that we are also human beings? Do you know what I mean? Have you ever met a human woman? How can you ever think that's something? The outfit that I used to wear was thick gloves and thick socks that were sent from Saudi Arabia. They're mailed to me from Saudi Arabia, covering my face head to toe in black. I'm in Canada, so I am privileged and lucky because I'm in the north and it's a lot colder than women who have to wear that in Saudi Arabia, where it can go up to 50 degrees Celsius. A human being wanting to wear black, covering themselves up head to toe, stifling their, they can't see, they can't hear, they can't speak, they can't smell, they can't touch, in a black nylon in 50 degrees heat. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
To ever think that any woman would want to do that, that she isn't doing this because she's being coerced in some way. It's more than condescending and patronizing. It's insulting. It's like dehumanizing.
It is dehumanizing.
To think that we would be okay with that, or that we would find that empowering.
And there
just stop.
And there are problems. I think this is another theme that runs through as well, is that, of course, there are problems in a sort of extreme individualistic approach that is totally libertarian and doesn't acknowledge the importance of social connections and the relevance of groups and identities, of course. But if you go the other way and just say this is just an anonymous, amorphous group, and we will completely ignore the suffering of the individual sentient human beings within that, mm-hmm. something has gone very wrong, mm-hmm. and it can lead to dark places. And I love the point earlier on. Sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
I love the point you made earlier on about this is not a Western Enlightenment thing that was invented in the last few years. You don't have to do much digging to recognize that the roots of, for one, a naturalistic worldview go back super deep and ancient. And the other side of the sentientism idea, this compassion for all humans and indeed all non-humans, again, has deep ancient roots in Rastafarianism and Jainism and Buddhism. One of my favorites that I found, I've got this wall on the sentientism.info page of suspected celebrity sentientists, people who've never heard of the word, but probably think this way. And there's a blind Arab philosopher called Al-Mari, who was writing, I think, about over 1,000 years ago, who was explicitly talking about there is no God. I have a naturalistic worldview, use evidence, and was explicitly saying it's wrong to eat non-human animals because they suffer too. And like, this was way pre-Enlightenment, right? So those roots are deep and rich, and it's super arrogant for people like me to say, oh, we invented this a few hundred years ago. We invented this. And the only thing that's hesitating about us sharing that with the world is that we're nervous. We've got some dodgy colonial history. It's patronized. And I think the thing that can cut through all of this is a genuinely universal compassion, right? Mm-hmm. Because compassion recognizes differences in groups and identities and the social networks we have and the relations we have. And all of that is super important. But it has to come ultimately back to the experiences of individual sentient beings, because they're the ones that suffer or flourish. And that has to be, for me, the root of all moral value. And that universal compassion can cut through so much of the bullshit we see, even though it leads you to some uncomfortable places, right? It leads you to recognize there's oppression within oppressed groups. It leads you to recognize that there are behaviors we've come to see as normal, whether it be animal farming or things we do to other humans. You mentioned infant genital mutilation is a great example that we've come to see as normal. But when you just think about the suffering and the harm and the need, you see it in a very different light. And I think the other thing that a universal compassion helps us to do is defend against this risk that we end up joining a sort of another in-group, out-group battle, right? So one group that is absolutely comfortable challenging Islam and the more fundamentalist aspects of Islamic ethic are the, for example, the authoritarian Christian right. And there's a real danger that in resisting one extreme, you end up joining forces with the other. And the one thing that I think both of those two groups have, one is they're both right wing, one is they're both authoritarian, and the other one is they both love fighting each other, right? So so that's another area where I'm hoping in this breathtakingly naive way that if we can come back to this sort of much more unashamedly universal, humanistic and even sentiocentric way of thinking, we can avoid joining that battle. And to cut back to what should be a common ground for all human beings is recognizing that causing needless suffering is a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you say is true on the right wing. And then on the left wing, you have the anti-Western, the far left.
Yeah.
You have the anti-Westerners all supporting each other. So that's where you would also have Islamists and communists and whatever that hate Western civilization. So they will also ally with each other.
Yeah, again, it's become tribal. And because it becomes so viscerally tribal, you blind yourself deliberately to the problems of your teammates and your co-groups. And I think that's another difficulty as well, because even this idea of suggesting something universal is really problematic to some people, right? Because again, the history of universal ideas can sound quite oppressive. It's like, we have the one right answer. We're going to impose it on the rest of the world. We know where that leads to another flavor of its own awful horrors. But to my mind, as long as you're very careful about what you're being universal on, i.e. evidence and reason and naturalism, and seeing that all sentient beings matter morally, those to me feel like really safe, foundational, universal principles. And then we can be radically pluralistic on everything else. You can have a dizzying array of different views and approaches and ethical systems and cultures. But at some base level, we have to find some way of agreeing to engage with reality honestly and trying to understand it and recognizing the moral value of every sentient being. So in a way, that's why I'm almost suggesting we can have as long as we're careful about it, we can have an unashamedly universal approach. And in a way, I'm quite frustrated that movements like the humanist movement seem so silent in today's debate, because I think that unashamed universalism, whether it be for all humans or my preference, all sentient beings, can cut through a lot of the division and tribal challenges we're facing today and we've faced for hundreds of years.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think that that's one thing that religious people know how to do well. They're very good at supporting each other and at being like a cohesive group, and then they can get things done.
Yeah.
Because of that, obviously.
And as we've hinted at already, atheists can do that too. Vegans can do that too. This sort of tribal thing can catch all of us.
We're not nearly as good at it. We haven't had as much practice. Yeah. And also because of the fact that you are an atheist or a humanist or agnostic means that you really are a nonconformist, yeah. Especially if you came from religion and now you're no longer believing in it. You are trying to herd cats. So I work with the Ion Hirsielli Foundation, where we work with a lot of different organizations and a lot of individuals where we're trying to have a cohesive group or a cohesive voice. We're all such individuals in this area that it makes it much more interesting, but much more challenging.
Yeah, because it's pluralistic and it's diverse,
side, yeah. Yeah, the religious side, you have leaders and then you have 80% sheep. We don't have as many sheep on our side. So it makes things, I enjoy it more. It makes it more, like I said, challenging and fun, but also means that we are really hindered when it comes to having a united, into getting things done.
Yeah.
So when you say that you lament that the humanist organizations aren't moving in that direction, I can totally see that, but it's probably because there's so much disagreement and indecision within each group, let alone getting all the groups to
have. I agree. And I think they're also very scared of stepping on cultural landmines. So.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
I should really let you go because it's been fascinating to talk to you for nearly 2 hours. But just to close out, given all of that and your mind-bending journey so far and the contributions you're making now, how do you feel overall? Do you feel optimistic, pessimistic, somewhere in between about our ability to make the world a better place?
Very optimistic, incredibly optimistic. I think that I'm a lot more optimistic than other people because I lived there. I was in that darkness and I was so deep inside in it. I was inside it. I was a part of that whole monstrous mechanism. And so the fact that I was able to leave that, walk away, watch my two daughters grow and flourish and live free lives, it's so hopeful. And working with my organization, Free Hearts, Free Minds, you can feel hopeful too if you click on the tab called Testimonials, where people tell you their stories of what it was like when they first contacted us and now how they felt after they've gone through the sessions. And it's step by step. It's one by one. What is that Buddhist saying about a forest of 1,000 trees starts with one little seed? And so you just keep going. And we can see, if we step back and we do the Steven Pinker thing and we look at how much humanity has improved over time, how much we have progressed over time, there's no reason to feel despair. I think that I have such faith in humanity, and I know that we are trying our best all the time to move forward. Sometimes it looks like we're tripping up and we're stepping back. I think this is a moment in time where it feels like we might be going a little bit backwards. Mm. One of my favorite quotes is from The Great Gatsby, where he talks about we are but boats. And oh gosh, it's one of my favorite quotes and I can't remember it right now. But basically, sometimes we lull backwards. Yeah. It feels like we're lulling backwards, but we are essentially moving forward. And yeah, I think if I wasn't a ridiculously optimistic optimist, I probably wouldn't have survived.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really do feel like even with all the negativity that's happening in the world today, it's happening because people are genuinely trying to do what they feel is best.
Yeah. thank you. That's an inspiring note to end on. It's been brilliant to hear your amazing story and your philosophical journey as well. What's the best way of people finding Free Hearts, Free Minds, reading your book, Unveiled? I can include links in the show notes, of course. But
my website, yasminmuhammad.com, and I'm very active on Twitter, Yasmin Muhammad on Twitter. And I've also got an Instagram and a Facebook. And I've got other things too, but I don't use them. I have to, it's just too much.
Yeah.
But I'm mostly active on Twitter. And yeah, so I have a book club that I do every month as well. On my website, yasminmuhammad.com, you can find information about my book club as well. But yeah, please look up Free Hearts, Free Minds, read the testimonials, be inspired by their stories, and hopefully be moved to support them.
Brilliant. Thank you. And let me know if I can help you on your inexorable journey to veganism as well. You'll be having one of these t-shirts soon too. So.
Yes.
All right. Thank you again so much. You're a true.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?